You go by Tim, though, right?
Correct.
Timothy. Yeah. Okay. Good?
Yeah, we got that on the podcast.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, now everybody knows.
Now he goes by Tim.
Timothy goes by Tim.
Yeah. Tim, Carney, great to have you. Great to be able to talk to you. Welcome to Oklahoma.
Thank you, man.
Yeah. So you kind of write for a living. You talk about political stuff. You talk about Jesus. You have a great family. What else about Tim Carney?
Yeah, now I'm a political reporter and like think tank guy in D.C. I'm a Catholic with six kids. And actually, a lot of what I write about is D.C. sort of being this corrupt swamp, but it's actually an amazing place to raise kids in a Catholic environment. There's great, we have great Catholic schools. The Diocese of Arlington, where we are, is amazing. And I've written a couple books on lobbying, on corporate welfare, but then more recently on community and now on family, trying to tell people that actually babies are a good thing.
Yeah, babies, shocker, life is good. Yeah, that's very interesting that you wrote a book on the family, on culture, living in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. Like, I have a bias, obviously, being in Oklahoma, yep. Thinking, like, that's...
Right, everything there must be
like
the worst.
A moral wasteland. You know, although Richland...
You can't even get Dr. Pepper in Washington, D.C.
But Richmond is a great diocese.
Well, so we're Arlington. Which is Northern Virginia. But also, just, I would say, I mean, my pastor is named Father Scalia.
Oh, well, that's fantastic.
And then, you know, Clarence Thomas shows up at Sunday Mass. And the kids' schools, again, we've got amazing schools. And one of the things, so that I'm at a think tank called the American Enterprise Institute. And historically, they had three departments. They had foreign defense policy, like, let's have a lot of war. They have economics policy, very free market. They had a domestic policy on education mostly and stuff like that. And then recently they added a department called Social, Cultural, and Constitutional Studies, sort of to zoom out and write about the stuff that matters more. But that idea that culture is a thing that matters, in Washington, D.C., a lot of people don't like that because I'm not just talking about government. I'm not talking about measurable things like economics. I'm talking about things like marriage, having kids, how you understand the human person. All of those things affect our politics, our state, our position in the world, our economy. They're all downstream, I argue, from the cultural stuff. So in Washington, to be doing work about culture, studying it, writing about it, saying this stuff really matters, is a little countercultural, but thankfully, you know, at AEI, we've got a department just doing that.
That's awesome, yeah, because politically that's not popular because that's not something the politicians can control.
That's right. And so sometimes I do get to meet with and I sit down with congressmen and I tell them, so the problems that I talk about in my new book, Family Unfriendly, is we have a low birth rate, it's falling, and we have an epidemic of childhood anxiety. And congressmen will be like, okay, what can I do about this? I'm like, well, you can pray and fast. You can have more kids.
And then they're like, anything else?
Yeah.
And I do think there is federal policy that has to go with this. But a huge part of my argument is, and also I will say, this is affecting your district more than your laws are. In other words, if there's a lot of children being raised without a dad, or if there's a lot of people growing up and like, I have no interest in getting married. I mean, has an incredible negative effect on day-to-day life of everybody else. And so it's sometimes a hard slog to make the case that we really do have to care about culture.
You know, it is interesting, though, because I have noticed in the last 6 months, maybe really it's just the last 3 months, very recently, politicians actually starting to talk about the low birth rate.
Yes.
As a problem, as an American problem that we need to address.
And it's funny, because in Europe they've been talking about it for decades. But and in 2012, if you go back to then, or about 2008, people would say the wealthy world has low falling birth rates except for Israel and the United States. And then now they just say except for Israel, because we are down to 1.62 babies per woman is the total fertility rate. It's what it's called. And so, but we still didn't talk about it, even though our birth rate started falling in 2008. And when I would talk about it, people would be like, it's kind of gross. Why are you telling women what to do with their bodies? Like, why is it your business? And so some of it was this feminism. A lot of it was this sort of atomized hyper-individualism of like, it's just a choice. I'm not going around complaining that not enough people are buying like fishing boats And isn't having a kid just another consumer choice? But you're right. Recently, it started coming up. I think J.D. Vance was the first, was like the second Republican senator to mention it on the floor of the Senate in 30 years. And back 30 years ago, when they were talking about birth rates, they were worrying about overpopulation.
Right. Right. Oh, yeah.
And then at the March for Life, J.D. went up there and said, I want more babies born in the United States. Not just I want fewer abortions. I want more babies born. He wants more young people getting married, starting a family, making it as big as they can. That is brand new in American politics.
It's very hopeful.
It is. And but so then the question is, can the White House do anything about it? I think the most important thing they can do is J.D. Vance go out and say, hey, I want more babies. And then actually, I don't know if he listens to this podcast, and I don't think you should do what you know, with your family, what you should do for the sake of messaging to the country. But man, if J.D. and Usha had two more babies in the 4 years that they were in the White House, that would be the most pronatal thing possible for this administration.
Yeah, because I don't know if Donald Trump can sign an executive order. Look, okay, we need more babies. I came in here and I was like, guys, we have to have more babies.
So what do you think the role is for the government? Like, how do they help the family?
So it depends whether we're talking state, local, federal.
Sure.
On the local level, there's lots of stuff. I mean, I talk about the built environment is a term that like urbanists would use. Chapter 3 of my book is titled, if you want fecundity in the sheets, you need walkability in the streets. So my argument is people would have more babies if they could let their kids run around the neighborhood when they're 6, 8, 10, 12. Like, I'm Gen X. Like, we were not necessarily kicked out of the house, but we walked out of the house and we were told, be home for dinner.
But yeah, what but when it? You walked out of the house, the door did lock.
Yeah, it's like behind us. Yeah. And so what does that require? A, it requires safety from crime. The fact is that, you know, we had a recent crime wave after 2020, and that's basically abated. Our suburbs especially are safe. They're safer than they were when I was a kid. Second, though, it requires a culture that allows you to do that. Where I used to live in Montgomery County, Maryland, free-range parents got arrested for letting their kids go to the playground by themselves. But C, it involves actual sidewalks and, like, bike trails. And so the only people who talk about walkability these days, I feel most of them are, like, hipsters who want to be able to walk to their...
It has nothing to do with a family.
Yeah.
It has to do with a lifestyle.
Walk to a Marxist coffee shop and to their cocktail bar.
Yeah, because they want to take their dog.
And they want to be able to, you know, even if I have to drive to work, if my kids don't have to get in the car, that's a good day. And think about, and I mean, what's a great summer vacation? It's where your kids are totally free, they're totally unsupervised, and you're not getting in the car with them. And when they're little, oh gosh, they're in the car seats and you're buckling them and unbuckling them. If you do more than one stop, it's like you're on those 5-point harnesses. You have to reach your hand to get that one thing that's stuck underneath them into this slurry of like chewed up goldfish and butt sweat and spit up to pull it out.
You're hoping it's just sweat.
Yeah.
You just convince yourself it's just butt sweat.
Just sweat. Fine.
And that's unpleasant for the parents. It's unpleasant for the kids. And again, once the kids are 6, they should be able to run around the block. Once they're a little bit older, they should be able to run around the neighborhood. But in modern suburbia and lots of modern America, they have to be, you know, 16 and a half with their driver's license, and you have to be able to afford to get them a car before they have real freedom. And that's so that's a local issue. If we go up to the federal issue, I think that I argue for a larger child tax credit. That is just a basic fairness measure. I hate most tax credits because there's like buy an electric car or get a tax. No, it's not my job to subsidize your lifestyle choices. But having a child is not just a lifestyle choice.
Right.
Like, this is literally...
It's the community. This is how we sustain and
this
live.
Is how we sustain. It's a first commandment. Be fruitful and multiply. And it is like we build laws for the sake of people. Remember that whole for the people... For the people. People are the thing for which we build laws. So the tax code should say, if you have 8 people in your household, which I do, then you're paying less in taxes than one person on the same income because that income's getting divided across 8 people. And when they're teenage boys, their food budget is about 5 people each.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, currently you get more like a... I think it's still the case. You get a larger child tax credit when they're 5 and under or 6 and under.
That was only for 1 year under Biden. Okay. Yeah.
Well, I've always thought it should be the other way around. Like, do you know how much an infant costs? It's like nothing. I mean, they literally just sit there. They have no interests, no hobbies. Like, you don't even buy them birthday presents.
I was thinking about first birthdays. I have a theory that the first birthday party should have nothing to do with the kid. It should just be a celebration of the mom.
Yeah.
Because the kid doesn't even know what's happening.
Oh, absolutely.
The party should be you give the baby to grandma, grandpa, and mom and dad get to go take a nap.
Yeah.
You deserve a nap. You made it 12 months.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. Because, yeah, the kid has... You don't even go back and look at pictures of your first birthday party. Like, you just don't care about that.
This is great. We're going to start a new cultural tradition. But the reasoning for the child tax credit being bigger for kids under 6 is they're not in school yet. And so either you're subsidizing childcare or you're subsidizing a parent staying home.
See, I just hate that mentality. I hate everything about that mentality, as if the default, the standard, the baseline is that obviously the federal government is going to be taking care of your kids, you know, and that, you're not old enough.
I think a stay-at-home mom benefit is kind of awesome. And France basically has that.
Oh, yeah. I'm a big fan of stay-at-home mom benefits.
France has a paid leave program, but if... By your third child, you get 3 years of it. So, and your first child's only get like 6 months of it. But more or less, since we had kids every other year, my wife would have been paid for the first 11 years that she stayed home and be under France's policy.
Wow.
So
I can't remember if it's Denmark, it's some other country.
Wait, hold on real quick. Let me. Sorry. Is that from the government or from the business?
That's from the government. And so there's a lot going on in there, and I've studied a lot of the different countries that have tried to have pronatal policy. I think that's one of the most effective. It's super expensive. Like, we could not afford to get from 1.6 kids to 2.1 by trying to do that. But what it does is they're basically saying whether or not you work or, you know, and do childcare or stay at home, you're going to get money. And that's a
like
pretty
a base
good,
income, not yeah. like your income you had before.
It's some fraction of it, a third or something
oh,
like
okay,
that.
Oh, okay.
And so, but what the previous administration, the Biden administration, they didn't like that. And there's a lot of sort of free market economists who don't like it either because it reduces the GDP. Because not only are you not paying child care, mom's not making any money. And even worse, if she's staying home, she might be like buying raw ingredients and cooking instead of ordering takeout or taking the kids out to fast food. All of that stuff depresses the GDP. So you take that, you combine it with the feminism, the sort of total egalitarian gender equity, gender symmetry actually is a term I came across, gender symmetry feminism that says there shouldn't be any noticeable difference between the way men live and the way that women live. And that's why you get this push in a lot of European countries and from parts of the Biden administration to say what we need is universal child care. So that way when you have a baby, it doesn't interrupt your career except for maybe your, you know, 2 months of maternity leave, and then you're right back on track and you shouldn't be able to tell the difference between a mom, a dad, and somebody without kids.
Yeah, once again, outsourcing all parenting and responsibilities. I wish I could remember which country this is. They did something, not exactly what France did, but after a woman had one child, her taxes would be reduced by 25%. After number two, it was 50. And if you had four kids, the woman it was just on her income.
But see, that's the thing. Hungary does that.
Is that who it is, Hungary?
Yeah. Okay. Hungary does that just on the woman's income. But again, that wouldn't help me. My wife's income.
It should be
for the past
joint income.
18, it should be joint income. But also, Hungary is also a good story about what a country should do. Because I think there's lots of interesting discussions among sort of my conservative DC circles of what is the proper role of the government. How much should the government be neutral on questions? It certainly shouldn't be anti-family. It should be neutral on some issues, and it should be pro-family on some issues. But then for me, the question, if you say the government should be pro-family or the government should be promoting this good thing, I always say, will that work? That's always going to be my first question. In Hungary, they had a big birth rate decline. The policies from Viktor Orban help flatten it. There's a little uptick. and now it seems to be going down again. I'm going to Hungary in a couple weeks, but right now my analysis of what happened is they helped most families speed up their births, which is a good thing, right? It's better to have kids as quickly as you want rather than to feel for economic reasons you have to space them out.
Sure.
But they, for most families, it did not increase the number of babies they have because that's too much based on personal, well, personal situation, but really your view of marriage and life. Like if you don't take this radically sacrificial idea to marriage and family, the idea of having four, five kids is just an insane thing to do. The ROI is pretty low measured in standard terms. But I do think that for religious families that were middle class or working class, it did help increase the birth rate. Because the tax benefit isn't the only thing. There's a whole slew of marriage benefits, okay, of other family benefits that the government provides. And so for a small slice of the population, and I actually, most of the people I know in this situation are Jewish. They have three kids. They say they want to be fruitful and multiply. There is no way they would send their kids to a Montgomery County public school. And so they have to pay Jewish school tuition, mm-hmm, which is higher than Catholic school tuition because we get subsidies from occasional nuns or, you know, Opus Dei numeraries who don't need to get paid that much. And so their Jewish school tuition is much higher. And they say that's the number one contraception in their neighborhoods, is that they can't afford Jewish school tuition for more than three kids. So a little bit more money to those people or a school choice program, that's the kind of situation for a religious portion of the population that would drive up the birth rate.
That's something we just did here in Oklahoma. We instituted a
university.
It's not exactly school choice, but it's a private school tax credit.
Yeah.
Which has, it's brand new, so it's got some kinks,
yeah,
and some bumps, but I think it's really a great program.
Yeah, and I mean I wanna see how that works.
So let me ask you what your philosophical opinion is on, you know, okay, something you said like France.
I said babies are good. Oh,
yeah.
Sorry, go
on. Yeah, like, so like on this, on a policy, you know, like basically paying the income of a woman. I have, and it's just the way I've been raised, I think, like, mm-hmm, natural inclinations that push back against that because it sounds like socialism to me.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think it's an interesting question. My worry is that when the government is paying you, they then start telling you what to do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this is sort of a practical aversion. It's not just a pure principled objection to the government doing it. It's a practical aversion to it. And this is what I worry about with school choice. Like, I live in Virginia now. If they did a school choice thing and then, you know, there's a liberal majority and a liberal governor, they're going to be like, oh, yeah, you guys can get this money as long as, like, you ordain women or, you know, that, yeah, you fly the pride flag or something. So there's that worry. Two, a lot of government support programs end up being anti-family by creating bad incentives. So this is a huge policy debate in D.C. It's what we spend a lot of our time on. How could a bigger child tax credit help poor people more who don't even owe $4,000 in taxes without having the negative effects? What are the negative effects? A huge one is deterring marriage. That if you lose some of your benefits by being married to a man with income, you're less likely to get married. Even if in the long run it would pay off just economically, it acts that way. Another is if a child is being raised by a single mom and she never works, then he's raised without an example of a working adult. That is literally the definition of intergenerational policy. So I'm not answering with a philosophical answer. I'm giving you sort of a policy wonk answer of why to be worried about government giving people money. But I'll give you another practical one. I wonder if government programs that support families, like Hungary, that, and Israel has it to some extent, they're not huge, how much could it run the risk of creating antipathy from like a moderately religious majority towards the more religious minority? Right now, if I'm walking around with six kids, nobody is thinking, oh, that guy's a welfare queen. My wife's walking around with six kids. For some reason, they feel they have the right to say. One guy in the grocery store said, you know, you don't have to do everything the Pope tells you. Like, in the grocery store, just because she had six kids.
It's like, what do you think the Pope is telling people?
Yeah. And then
the one my wife gets a lot is like, are all of these yours? Or, you know, like they try to politely ask, are these all from the same
woman?
Or like,
same man.
Same man, you know, but like without being rude, but they can't help themselves, like ask.
Well, so
beat around the bush, you know?
Sometimes, though, in my circles, like they're not all mine, and there's like too many that are the same age, but there's also different ages. And once I was sitting in line to get on a hayride, and I had like three families around me, and somebody said, are those all yours? And they couldn't have possibly been all mine unless there was like multiracial quintuplets going on. And one of my wife's friends popped over and goes, yeah, you know us Irish people, we can't control ourselves. but anyway, if you have too much of a welfare state for families, I think it could create sort of a resentment of people saying like, look, these people are just popping out babies for the check, and that we popping out babies and raising them is a hugely, again, self-sacrificial thing, and we shouldn't try to take that away.
Yeah. So what do you think about, I think that a lot of this stems also from a lack of fatherhood. There a lot of our problems stem from it's easy to be it's easy to be a father. It's not easy to be a dad, so to speak. Like mm-hmm. You can easily procreate. It's very hard to raise a child. How do we support? A lot of the attention goes to supporting the wives. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great thing. I'm pro that idea. But how do we support men into being men who are not leaving their wives behind, not being pro-family as well.
Yeah, so actually, there's a lot going on in there, from the extreme case of telling fathers to take responsibility.
Father,
we have to overcome a sort of feminist fear of the patriarchy and say, you should marry your baby mama. But they're like, oh, well, what if she doesn't? Okay, if she doesn't want to, she's not going to marry him. But, like, you should marry your baby mama. The old idea of a shotgun wedding, there's some downsides of that, but there's a lot of upsides. So, or you could even mitigate it. If she'll marry you, you should marry this woman. So from that extreme all the way over to just, I think, in when I think about my circles, upper middle class suburbs, dad's just, it is not your job to simply be the breadwinner. I had a guy in my parish say that. He's like, oh, my wife takes care of that. I've got a simple job. I'm just the guy who pays the mortgage and the tuition bills.
It's like, you're missing it, man.
But he was also lying. Like, he felt like that was like an old-fashioned, like, boomer thing to say and believe. And I was like, that's not true. I was just coaching against you in first grade basketball, okay, dude? Like, you clearly don't believe that. But to make sure that no dad believes that, I think, is a big part of it. And so culturally, to sort of glorify fatherhood. And I have a friend, a guy I appear on a lot of these stages with, who is trying to lobby the NBA to get people like LeBron, who are married to the mother of their children, to be like, look, on the court, I'm the king. Here, I'm like double king.
Yeah.
But every king needs his queen. And like, that would be huge for the black community, where fatherlessness is much more prominent. But for everybody else, I really do think that like the cultural valorization of fatherhood as something different from motherhood, or dadding as something different than mommy. I have a picture. I gotta like publish this of my 6-year-old took this photo of me playing basketball against my son, and me jumping up, and you can just see clearly I'm blocking the shot. My son was 7 at the time. So,
in your face.
Yes, totally rejecting your 7-year-old son is so fun. And he laughs about it, and he loves it, and he talks trash, and he's 9, 10 now, and one day he's going to beat me.
And day he's going to do that to you and be like, take that, dad.
Yeah. He's going to make it into a poster and put it on my wall. And my wife has no interest in dunking on our kids.
Right.
And if momming and dadding are different things. And so just like really elevating it, I think a lot of that is going to be sort of cultural work and holding up models of stuff. And I talk about this in Family Unfriendly, where I say part of it is going to be in the workplace. Of when I was an editor of the opinion page at the Examiner, I made it very clear. I was like, I have family dinner at 6. It takes me sometimes an hour to get home. I'm not going to be here after 5 p.m. If you have an absolute emergency, text me. Otherwise, email me when my kids are in bed. I'll check it. And I made that clear for everybody else. Family matters more. If you weren't married, didn't have kids, your dad was sick, that mattered. Don't worry. Just go and take care of that. If you had something else that you really cared about, one guy was like, I'm not getting married. I'm not religious. Why? You know, the Jewish guy gets off for the Sabbath. You are home for dinner every night. What accommodation do I get? I was like, you know what? You don't get as much. because we value faith and family more. And so in a workplace,
and you're not sacrificing as much, right? Like you're sacrificing,
yeah,
you know, certain aspects, and then because you, and you get some reward for that, right?
Like, yeah.
I don't ask my son to do the same thing I do for Lent.
Yeah.
Right.
And the more goods you order yourself towards, the more goods you receive in return, right? So if you're a religious father, you're ordered towards this highest good. He's not. So I don't know why you would expect
as
much in return.
Organizing institutions around that, like I don't know what's legal or illegal in DC employment law, but we've got to say these things matter more. And for a boss, I've always had bosses who said, family's more important than this job. And that's, I don't think, true for most people. But that's the main place, because that's the main competitor for Father's Times, is the workplace, is to say, hey, you know what? You might have to bust your butt after you put your kids to bed to get your work done, but you should get home. And for me, I always just said, look, I'm leaving. Not like one guy I knew worked at a bank, when everyone wanted to get home or get to his kid's game, he would run out with a FedEx envelope at 5:58 p.m. because that's when the FedEx window closed, to pretend that he was doing work. A dad who's a leader should say, all right, going home for family dinner, and just set that tone throughout the workplace.
Yeah.
That's why I call my family-friendly feminism, because women are already doing that, and they're leaving the workplace. They're going and being moms. Dads have to feel like, yeah, I might have to be the breadwinner, but I'm going to have to figure out how to do that as the second most important thing in my life.
Mm, absolutely. So if you're the president or you're the mayor or the governor, whatever it is, whatever position you think would be the best to be for this question, what would you do from an organizational government standpoint? What would be the thing that you think is the most important change from the government to help build strong families?
Yeah. So from the local government, it would be the kid walkability, bikeability, playgrounds. Kids should be able to get to, 14-year-old get to his job, 12-year-old get to the pickup basketball game, 10-year-old get to his friend's house. All of that requires sidewalks, crosswalks, yada yada, and being less car focused. A lot of people hate it when I talk about, you know, slowing cars down, but that's what we need to do. On the state level, I would talk about the educational system. It should be preparing people to be parents as well as for the workforce. And you know, this is horribly, you know, anti-feminist, but like some jobs are better. Like I know lots of women, the woman who edited the first draft of my book, she's a stay-at-home mom, and she just did it when she had time. Once I said, when can I talk to you about this last chapter, she said, when my kids are napping, if I don't need a nap, I might give you a call. Like it was a perfect stay-at-home mom job. What if the educational system was guiding people towards that and making it clear that your vocation, and most people, it's going to be marriage and family, is something you need to think about as much as or more than your family. And on the federal level, again, I think setting the norms, I'd increase the tax credit a little bit. Oh, on the state level, I'd also make housing more affordable. I think for the most part, when people say we're not having kids because it's unaffordable, I think for the most part that's BS. But in the last 4 years, the cost of owning a home has gone way up. And my analysis of the data said that that actually does drive down the birth rate. So getting rid of regulations, building more houses, all of that stuff, that's the number one thing that on the state and federal level can be fixed.
Wonderful.
What's a recent article that you've written that you were like, yes, that one hit? Like, you know, I've written a few articles, and there's some where you're like, yeah, that one's okay. And
that one is finished.
Yeah, that one's, yeah, exactly. That one's finished. And there's some you're like, yes, I feel good about this. What's one that you feel good about?
When my book came out, I got a piece in the Washington Post. My initial headline was, make your life easier, have four kids. And my son Sean walked up to me and said, what the hell, Dad? Because he's number five. But the Washington Post changed the headline to the ideal number of children in a family, four at a minimum, which, of course, triggered the Washington Post readership. And I think I made a really good argument that, in fact, parents make their lives easier when they have four or more kids, in part because, chapter one of my book is titled, Have Lower Ambitions for Your Kids. You no longer think you can do everything. You no longer putting them in every travel sport and driving them everywhere and helicoptering them at every moment. And that's better for the kids. Childhood anxiety is mostly about kids growing up without unsupervised play. Parental stress is mostly this false belief that you control them. And then the responsibilities you give the older kids. I'm a youngest, and I think I benefited so much from my older brother's mistakes. One of these days, I want to do a podcast.
Where I know my younger brother did.
Yeah. I just want to talk about my older brother's mistakes for an hour once in one of these podcasts, but I won't do that. And so that got the most comments of any article on the Washington Post website in 2024. I don't think all of the comments were positive. They were about overpopulation.
Yeah, I'm sure they weren't.
They were about controlling women's bodies. They were about me being a bad dad. I still have these Twitter trolls who aren't even liberals. They're just weird, like, Rousseauian people on Twitter who are like, Tim Carney outsources his parenting to the neighbors and the pool lifeguard while he goes ahead. And it's like, you're saying I'm involved in the community instead of just hovering over my children.
Yeah.
And that's an attack on me. So that one landed.
Yeah, I like that. Okay, so your book, Family Unfriendly, how our culture made raising kids much harder than it needs to be. That's the most recent one?
Yes.
Okay, and where can they get that?
It's everywhere. It's
Amazon, typically.
It's Amazon. Maybe search for your artisanal online website.
If you still have a bookstore in your area.
Well, no. I had trouble even getting some public libraries to carry this.
The libraries are the worst, bro.
My previous book was like had outreach to the left. It was clear. This one just is coded. It's about why you should have babies. It's written by a dude. It's not explicitly Catholic until the last two chapters. But I'm having trouble. So your local independent bookstore might not carry it, but you should tell them to carry it.
All right.
Awesome. And you follow you on X and everywhere, anywhere else?
Yeah, TP Carney. That's it. I guess on Instagram, I put up pictures of my dogs and kids once in a while. But yeah, Twitter's or X, as you call it, is a place to go.
Awesome. All right. Hey, man. Great. Welcome to Oklahoma. Glad you're
here.
Thank
you, man.
Thanks, Tim.
Cheers.